Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Julie Bindow. She's a journalist, broadcaster, author, and feminist campaigner living in London. She writes for The Guardian, New Statesman, Standpoint Magazine, The Spectator, and The Sunday Telegraph, reporting on culture, music, food, film, and sexual and gender identity. She's co-founder of Justice for Women, a feminist campaigning organization that supports and advocates for women who have fought back against or killed violent male partners. Julie has worked extensively on research concerning domestic violence, prostitution, and sex trafficking. So first, thank you so much for your work. And second, thank you for being on the program.
It's my pleasure.
So I want to talk about the larger issues that you work on routinely, but then I would like to start and maybe keep a lot of the focus today on something that's happening a lot lately, which is called no platforming or deplatforming. And can you tell people what that is and why it's important?
Oh, I mean, it's definitely reaching peak ridiculousness, no platforming. What it means is that if a speaker is booked to attend a debate or just a straightforward talk at a university or, in fact, any public forum, those that take offence at your views will adopt one of several strategies, or maybe all of them at once, to get you disinvited from the event. So the first thing that they will do is they will contact the organisers and they will say that you spout hate speech and even that you're breaking the law. They will then, if it's a commercial event, contact the sponsors and tell them similar. They will then contact the venue and the people that hire out the venue and say that by making the venue available for this particular event, they are contravening their equalities policy or whatever else they can come up with. It's mainly used through the National Union of Students here in the UK and possibly similar bodies in the US to stop people speaking at universities. But what's really interesting about it is that they often, through these National Union of Students sponsored events, allow former dictators, anti-abortionists, often gross misogynists to speak, but they will no platform radical feminists who are gender critical, who believe gender is a social construct, or who believe, like with many other Muslim born feminists, that the niqab, the veil, is a symbol of women's oppression, or, and this is on the increase, that we believe that the sex trade is inherently abusive and harmful to women. So what follows the accusations of hate speech is that we, feminists like myself, are whorephobic, transphobic, and Islamophobic. And the three often come together.
So historically, I don't know about in the UK, but in the United States, basically there was a time for 20, 30 years, maybe longer, where no platforming was primarily used in the United States by IPAC. That's basically by the pro-Israel lobby to deplatform people who disagreed with Israel's policies. Mm-hmm. And that it was pretty much their domain. They kind of had a monopoly on it. And then over the last 20 years, that has, or 15 years, 10 years really, has transformed over, it's now, there's been, according to an organization that, follows deplatforming, it's exploded. And it's been really taken up by certain parts of the left, especially. And is there a history in the UK of no platforming for outright fascists? Or was there sort of a free speech policy that was just a free for all that anybody could speak? And I recognize when you talk about dictators being invited that this question is kind of bogus in a way. And so if you'd either like to talk about how bogus this question is, great, or if you'd like to talk about a transformation so it's used more by the pro sex industry, etc. Pro sex exploitation industry.
Sure. We don't have the First Amendment, as many of your listeners will know, in the UK. But we have enjoyed freedom of speech, unless, of course, it breaks criminal legal boundaries for, 30, 40 years. And I think that we've got to the stage now where we take it for granted a little bit. But now the left has become the new right on many issues. So the history of no platforming at universities, and it was the National Union of Students that decided who was to be no platformed, is that fascist groups or individuals were the only ones that were no platformed. The question of Israel is one that came later, and it's far more likely that we would no platform pro-Israeli spokespeople and campaigners than we would pro-Palestinian groups. So I am on a list of a small number of individuals banned from speaking at universities. It is me and about five fascists. And I'm the only person apart from fascists that has been ever formally no platform. So there are several other feminists, radical feminists, not the fun kind, that have come after me, who now would probably be disinvited from speaking at a debate once the students heard that they are anti-prostitution, abolitionist, gender critical, in other words, believe that gender is a social construct and not innate. So that is starting to happen, but I'm the only one who's formally no platformed. And it would seem to be that the NUS don't even need to formally no platform many people now whose views they find offensive. They are simply making it impossible for universities to host these talks. The university officials are saying that they can't guarantee the safety of those that attend, and in particular the speakers. And of course, it's way too much trouble for other student groups outside of the NUS to host myself or other radical feminists or those that they find offensive, because they might have their funding for other student activities withdrawn. So it's a terrible kind of rise of the new McCarthyism. But as I say, the left has become the new right in that many of these students will happily host extreme Muslim clerics who say that women should be stoned to death if they're raped because it constitutes adultery. Or they will have anti-abortionists speaking, but they won't have me or my feminist colleagues who are critical of male violence. I mean, this is what it's coming down to.
I got recently deplatformed from a university in Oregon, and the actual reason that they gave, it has to do with my belief that women, including those who have been sexually assaulted by males, have the right to bathe, sleep, or organize free from the presence of biological males. And two things about this. One is that it kind of, there's a level at which it cracked me up because I have talked about the necessity to fight, or the option or possibility of fighting militantly against capitalism, or I have had a lot of controversial views, and it's kind of been strange that it's been very strange that none of those ever got me deplatformed. But the thing that's gotten me deplatformed is solidarity with women. Mm. And one of the lines when they were deplatforming, one of the lines that the professors actually said is they were afraid that I would, quote, hurt the feelings, mm-hmm. end quote, of some of the students. And
yeah.
Before we continue, I do want to talk about the threats, the lack of safety, all this other stuff of when they say they can't protect speakers from threats. I want to talk about that in a moment. But before that, can we talk about the implications of having discourse determined by whether it might hurt the feelings of some students and what that means for education and for discourse in general?
Well, let's talk about the feelings that, excuse me, are supposed to be being hurt. There was a really worrying but quite hilarious example that somebody shared with me yesterday about a meeting at the Feminist Society in one of the universities. And feminist societies are now increasingly being pretty much ruled and led by straight white men who think that they have something to say about this. And they'd invited a speaker who was straightforwardly a fairly controversial person who wasn't even a radical feminist. She was a feminist that suggested women should use their, what she called, sexual capital, and there's nothing wrong with getting ahead by flirting. And so she's one of these kind of neo-feminists that, you know, many of us in the trenches would disagree with. But because this woman was controversial, they decided that for those poor little babies, men and women, of course, because you're not allowed to have women only anything anymore, because it'll hurt the feelings of men, that those men and women who might be upset by hearing some of her controversial remarks would have a safe room next door to where the talk was going ahead. They would have pictures of puppies and kittens and gentle, soft music, and they'd be offered massage and actual therapy in case they were offended and upset. This is unbelievable. I mean, the level of pampering and privilege that we can see going on here, where you're not even allowed to test somebody's feelings by saying, might you find this offensive? Think about why. Might we talk about this from a different perspective? It might actually help you think. And that people are actually talking about being traumatized because somebody puts a different point of view across. And another example is the whole notion of safe spaces and trigger warnings. Now, everything that's written pretty much now, and, you know, your listeners will be well aware of this, I'm sure, if they've spent 5 minutes on the internet, is anything that's now written about issues to do with, you know, the sex trade or Muslim identity or feminism in general or the Middle East, that there's instantly a list of trigger warnings, such as this article contains a mention of rape or animal cruelty or transphobia or biphobia or criticism of polyamory. I mean, the list goes on and on. And then recently I realised that they'd stopped using the term trigger warning and it's now content note. And the reason why they stopped using trigger warning is because for some poor little babies, just the idea of a trigger of a gun being a violent weapon could actually throw them again into trauma. So they need these safe spaces from it. And I found out recently that my articles and much of my writing, of course, if it gets passed around amongst these Stepford students, is usually labelled with these trigger warnings, because just the very notion that I've written anything is offensive. And I've now found out that I am myself a trigger warning. They just put trigger warning, Julie Bindle. So they don't even have to list anything offensive that I've said, usually because there isn't anything that anyone could find. So we've become wrapped in cotton wool. There is now absolutely no room for any dissent or debate, but it's only about particular issues. You can be as misogynistic and sexist to non-trans women as you like. You can say the most horrific things to them and about them. But you try and ever pick apart any notion of a feminist discussion on gender or a feminist discussion on the veil. And, you know, you have caused great harm, not just offence, but you are actually committing acts of violence with your speech, the mantra goes.
So a couple things. One is, it seems like rhetorically, if you ignore how completely ridiculous the position is, that rhetorically it's a really smart manipulative tactic to basically say, if you disagree with me, you are doing violence to me, because then that position must hold the day.
And also means that in order to be big warriors in stopping violence, in stopping abuse, in stopping people being traumatized, they don't have to do the kind of activism I've done for 35 years, which is get out into the streets, waving placards, you know, stopping things from happening that causes real harm. They just have to say they've stopped me from speaking on campus, and therefore they've stopped trauma and they've stopped violence. And so there's no activism needed now. You know, these are keyboard warriors that think that they are revolutionizing the world by shutting down any debate whatsoever.
And so can we put this in, and I want to come back to more of just the sort of United States First Amendment, you know, or just free speech in general, the free speech horror of this, But for a second, can we go to the relationship between this and I keep thinking about the title of one of Susan Griffin's book, which is Pornography and Silence. And I keep thinking about the long history of silencing women. And I keep thinking about how it's just, it's very clear to me, like when in the United States they got rid of chattel slavery, then immediately or very quickly there was a transformation to the Jim Crow laws, and how so often when you make strides, when one makes strides in terms of helping to have an oppressed group or helping to when people are not considered people, as women, you know, have not been considered people, when they make strides, the oppression, the silencing of them will take a new form. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
I do. And my view is of the shutting down of any discussion based on radical feminist theory, which I think is just common sense theory that we've lived with for 4 or 5 decades and has some of the best thinkers attached to it than any social justice movement, is simply so that straight, white, highly privileged men can scream at radical feminists like myself. They can scream whorephobe, transphobe, shut your fucking mouth, and still be seen on the side of the progressives. So it is a gift to the men's rights movement, to the misogynistic men's rights movement, because of course all they have to do is to say that they're oppressed as a result of my biphobia, or me laughing at polyamory, or me suggesting that they're male when they say that they're female. I mean, this is all that needs to happen now. And at an anarcho-feminist conference recently, a colleague of mine was there, and she said that there were lots of white bearded men walking around with loudhailers shouting, "I am the safe space monitor. No transphobia, no biphobia, etc., etc. No whorephobia is allowed." And they were shutting women down. And when one of the women said, "I think that we should have a women born women only space to talk about growing up as girls and being sexually abused as girls," they were thrown out of the conference for being transphobic. But there was a women of colour only group that were meeting. There was a trans women only group meeting. So women now are the enemy. Lesbians are now seen as the oppressors, the enemy. I'm seen as the person who will oppress everyone from man to transgender person to polyamorous person. And yet as a lesbian and as someone who grew up working class and poor, you know, I find that deeply offensive that all of the oppression I've had to face and counter and use as a springboard to become a strong feminist is now being all completely turned around. I'm the privileged one. And that, of course, counts for all of my sisters in the same position.
So a couple things. One is that this is a tactic that we see, you know, one of the things that's really important to my own development as a thinker is Robert J. Lifton talks about how before you can commit any mass atrocity, you have to convince yourself and others that what you're doing is actually good. You have to have what he called a claim to virtue. So, and he was writing about the Nazis, among other things, and he would say that, you know, the Nazis didn't perceive themselves as committing genocide. They perceived themselves as purifying the Aryan race. And which doesn't mean they weren't committing genocide, of course. The point is that, and I've sort of extended this in my own thinking to just anything. You know, I've never in my life actually been a jerk. In my own perspective, I've had everything rationalized. And of course, objectively, I have been a jerk at times. And the point I'm trying to get at is I'm just sort of echoing what you just said about how it's a brilliant maneuver to take white males who are white heterosexual males who are pretty much the top of the hierarchy in this racist and sexist culture, and to turn those into victims That's just an extraordinary upside down world.
Mm. It's very clever and it's very Orwellian. And the emperor is wearing no clothes at all. And why it is that we have so many bystanders who are scared of challenging this is what really worries me. So we know there are always idiots and there are always horrendously offensive, hate-filled people that will choose a group, and in this case it's radical feminists and our allies, to bully and to target. And they've been doing this to me for a number of years, but in particular over the last decade. But what really concerns me are those that are being silenced in university feminist groups by the bullies, who are often the most privileged of the students there. I get emails all the time from young feminists saying, we were in a group, your name came up because we wanted to invite you to speak. We were screamed at, you're transphobic, you're triggering me. Your speech is violent if you support Julie Bindle. You know, she would be a danger to students' welfare if she came on campus. And they say, well, but this is ridiculous. She's campaigned against sexual violence for over 3 decades. She wouldn't come on campus to talk about trans issues unless she was asked, which incidentally I am invited by trans allies of mine regularly. And I always take up the invitation. But these are the small caucus of haters, of course. Now, what's happened to some of those young women is that they are scared of seeing. They're scared because they've seen what's happened to me. And they haven't, like me, they haven't got a public platform, you know, an established career, a decent enough income. I have nothing to lose because they're never ever going to stop this war against me. So I may as well continue. But for these young women, they do have a lot to lose if they speak out in support of me. So they're being seen as the silent bystanders. But the reality is that we're not enabling them. We're not protecting these young women from the bullying and harassment they're getting on my behalf, on our behalf. And then, of course, there are the others. There are the university lecturers who pander to this nonsense, you know, about gender being innate and how dare you spout hate speech at me in your lecture about gender being a social construct. That's transphobic. And these lecturers just go along with it. Lecturers who are quite critical of the sex trade are being bullied out of putting forward the view alongside the pro-sex industry nonsense that this is also the case. So there are lots of innocent bystanders and those that we're not enabling and protecting. And there are those who are cowardly, who are liberals, who think that they're being on the right side of social justice by protecting these vicious idiots. And we need to do something to change that. This is a small but very dangerous and vocal group.
How is it that, and this was, you know, my introduction to this process too, is how is it that you can be deplatformed as perpetrating hate speech at the same time that A, you're not actually, you're simply disagreeing, and then in addition, when they throw out death threats, I presume that you get death threats and rape threats routinely.
Die in a fire is thrown at me on a weekly basis, and not just me, others too.
Yeah, it's how is it that the perpetrators of the routine death and rape threats are not considered to be acting hatefully or to be, quote, triggering, end quote, anybody, but simply disagreeing with them? I mean, it seems to me that this is self-evidently absurd, that even if your positions were scary, which I don't find them scary, but even if your positions were scary, wouldn't the fact that the ones who are trying to silence you are routinely threatening to rape or kill you, wouldn't you think that shouldn't that be part of the equation when people are discussing who precisely is hateful?
It should, but what's happening is that the very small group of trans activists, and I do have to emphasize this, I have more trans friends and allies than there are the haters who are causing this problem. They're a very small group fueled by misogyny. This is nothing. This is not endemic to trans people's characters or existence. But what happens is that the trans haters will say, But we're not the ones tweeting die in a fire or kill TERFs, trans exclusionary, radical feminists and other such lovely names they have for us. You know, it's the odd, maybe slightly, you know, worn down, very vulnerable trans person who is only responding to the hate that Bindle and her crew spout. And people just take that as read, because most people haven't read anything at all that I've written on this issue. There was an article I wrote in 2004 that kicked all of this off that was a bit irresponsible and it used offensive humour, but my central premise I still stand by. But articles I've written on the issue since then have been considered, nuanced, many quotes from trans people in it. I've been critiquing the medical industry that exploit trans people, misdiagnose them, and I've looked at it from the feminist perspective that goes right back to Simone de Beauvoir, which is gender is a social construct, how can we be born in the wrong body, etc. Really straightforward feminist theory. But if you go onto campuses and ask students why Bindle is banned and why she spouts hate speech and is so traumatizing, they honestly won't have read anything. They just believe the folklore. So the trans people will say, you know, it's understandable that she gets told to die in a fire. We don't condone it. But we can understand how this, she's created an awful lot of trauma and upset. The sex workers' rights lobby, those that, you know, campaign for full legalization and normalization of the sex trade, they just say that I'm responsible, me or my feminist allies in this, we're responsible for the deaths of women in the sex trade, because by encouraging police to criminalize this further, we put the women in danger. We're responsible for this, not the police, not the Johns. So do you see what I mean? What they do is they attribute a huge amount of harm to our words and actions that way outweigh their odd insult to us. And the other thing that they say is, what's the problem with no platforming Julie Bindle? She's got national newspapers and radio and international speaking engagements as her platform. We just don't want her in our community, which is how they're now starting to refer to their university space. It's not a community. It's a place of learning. It's entirely different from suggesting that a fascist, you know, shouldn't go into, you know, an African-American housing project to speak about his horrific views.
I just want to add in here that when I was in college, one of the speakers who came to our university was Edward Teller, who was the model for Dr. Strangelove. I mean, you don't get too many people who are actually more offensive than Edward Teller.
True.
And the place was packed, and this was, like I said, when I was at university, and one of my classes was required to go. And afterwards in class, we had a delightful discussion about, with, you know, various students liking some of the things he said and some of them disliking him. And we had, this is what college is supposed to be, is this place where we had one of the few discussions I actually remember from that class, which got quite heated about, you know, how offensive or inoffensive his views were. I mean, isn't that kind of the point of college?
Exactly.
So I've heard that you're being attempted to, that there are attempts being made to deplatform or no platform you from a conference on censorship.
Yes.
And that seems like we have reached some sort of, you know, there's some sort of statue going to be awarded for irony here.
I think so. And in fact, you know, before I tell you about that, somebody sent me a tweet on email just saying this is the best trigger warning I've ever seen. And the trigger warning was attached to an article that this particular, you know, keyboard warrior was sending around. And the trigger warning was criticism of liberal feminism. That was the warning.
I can see why they would deplatform you for that. That's just horrendous.
I mean, honestly, but the no platforming attempts, the latest one anyway, is that I'm speaking at the University of Cambridge Festival of Ideas. I mean, note the, you know, title of ideas rather than doctrine. And I'm going to speak about the exclusion of certain voices on particular platforms. So it's not even about the technical no platforming that's going on, you know, towards me and other colleagues. It's actually about how we've lost the voice of, in this case, lesbian feminists, you know, because of the LGBTQQI lengthening acronym that I think degenders the experience that lesbians have that includes sexism and misogyny, and is different from the gay male experience. So that's my topic, and I came up with the idea that that's what I would talk about. But the keyboard warriors have noted that I'm speaking about hidden voices or silencing. And so they want to make a point that, in fact, I have way too much power and way too many platforms, and that the organisers should deplatform me. Now, I've seen the letter that they've sent to the organisers, and because this isn't a student group that's invited me, it's the academic staff. You know, they'll get nowhere with it at all, because the students have no tools with which to bully the academic staff. They can't threaten them with withdrawing any funding. But what they will do is of course try to set the fire alarm off during the conference or some other ridiculousness, and try and hijack it. And they'll be, rather than listening to what I'm saying, they'll no doubt be shouting and heckling. In fact, this whole no platforming policy in universities is a heckler's paradise, as long as the lecturers and the university bodies give into it. But yes, they're actually trying to stop me by saying that by being on campus, I will traumatise students, create an unsafe space for Muslims, sex workers, transgender people, queer people, gay men, because I have the nerve to actually critique some aspects of gay male culture, and pretty much anyone else. And the ludicrousness of this just leaves me kind of wide-eyed, because why don't they just come along and argue with me? It's a debate. They can come and argue. But of course, they've got out of the habit of ever challenging any ideas whatsoever. They just want their own ideas to be validated. And I'm not even sure what their ideas are anymore.
You know, this reminds me of a conversation I had years ago with a friend of mine, Jeanette Armstrong. She's an Okanagan Indian writer and activist. And there is somebody else had written an essay critical of a book written by Gerrymander. And I asked Jeanette what she thought of this critical essay. And she said, well, if he didn't like it, he should have just written his own damn book. And this was very early in my career. And I've taken that to heart, that if I don't like what somebody else says, I don't try to shut them up. What I do is I try to write a better book.
Oh, yeah.
Showing that my ideas are better than theirs.
Yes.
And it seems to me that that's, I mean, why would I, it would never occur to me to deplatform the people who have deplatformed me. It's like, great, you write your own thing, you give a talk, I'll give a talk, and then afterwards, you know, or maybe 2 years later when people think about it, then we'll see which idea is better. It seems that's the reasonable way to go.
Exactly, and I do get invited to do debates, panel sessions with trans people, and I always accept the invitation because they're always good allies, even if we're not going to agree with each other at the beginning or even at the end of the session. But we're always better friends at the end of the session. And every single time I get invited to do one of these talks, the so-called, you know, trans activists and their allies try and get the whole thing shut down, including screaming at the trans people who are on the platform with me that they are TERFs, that they are self-hating trans people, that they are the puppets of radical feminists. So they're even trying to block their own people from reaching out and trying to actually build this bridge. I've done a couple of events in the north of England that was co-hosted by a radical feminist group and a trans ally. And it was very important because we had a discussion, you know, half day discussions where we talked through the issues and tried to find a way forward so that radical feminists stop being no platformed and stop being too scared to speak out. But at the same time, where we can actually meet with our trans allies, nurture that communication that we have with gender critical trans people who are also opposed to the sex industry and who identify as trans, but don't see that as them having to prove that they're more of a female than a born female. I mean, where there's no hate or there's no contention, we're just all occupying the same space, trying to actually be social progressives together. And that's my vision for the future, for politics, for what we should be doing. And these haters, they are what's really incredible about how this issue has evolved since they started picking on me in 2004, is the way that the trans haters have become so indivisibly linked with the sex workers' rights activists that include pimps, johns, escort agency owners, profiteers, those that wish to see full decriminalisation of the entire industry. They are working hand in hand with that small number of trans activists to really destroy radical feminist activism and voices.
Can you just mention a few of the other people who have been routinely deplatformed? I know in the U.S., Chris Hedges recently got deplatformed because he thinks that prostitution is exploitative. He got replatformed when women spoke out vociferously in that they wanted them to speak. Can you talk about a few others? I know Sheila Jeffries gets a lot of, I've interviewed her twice. She gets a lot of attacks. Who else?
Well, my very, very old dear friend and colleague, Janice Raymond, is routinely no platformed. Wherever she goes in the world, there's always some kind of protest. Jan Raymond wrote the first book critiquing the diagnosis of transsexuality, as it was routinely known then, before sex became purposely conflated with gender to depoliticize it. A book called The Transsexual Empire that I think first came out in 1979. And since then, she's been hounded in every job that she's ever been in, every conference she's gone to, every book that she's written, her publishers have been hounded. So she is a big victim of this. And in fact, terrible things have happened to her. Alice Dredgner, do you know of her work? She is, I think she's a medical ethicist in the States, and she's done lots of work supporting intersex children, which is, of course, an entirely different issue from transgenderism. And she dared to support a colleague of hers who had offended the trans community, and they have made her life hell since. There are others who have, you know, been brave enough to suggest that that prostitution is abusive. And so Rachel Moran gets, who is a survivor of the sex trade and who you've interviewed, gets, you know, horrendous treatment. And when she was in Germany launching her book Paid For, which is brilliant, she missed a picket protesting her book reading by about a day. They were on the trail to shut down that that book reading. So there are a number of other women in the UK. Suzanne Moore is a great journalist and very good friend and colleague of mine. She's a feminist, but that isn't her primary political priority. She writes in The Guardian regularly. She has a regular column. She wrote one time about the ideal body image that's always being forced upon women. And she used the term, you know, we're expected to have legs like a Brazilian transgender, a transsexual. She obviously was using it just as some kind of, you know, acknowledgement that Brazilian, you know, transgender women legs, you know, often look very conventionally attractive to men. And she was hounded and bullied and vilified for this. Another colleague of mine, Beatrix Campbell, very old leftist activist, feminist, done amazing work on covering child sexual abuse. She's tried to say, stop this no platforming, stop this silencing of feminists. Me and her don't even agree on much about the sex trade, even. She's a bit more liberal than I am on prostitution and on other issues. But she has been bullied to the point of ridiculousness. So it's anyone that either says the kind of stuff that I do or that supports those of us that say it come in for the same treatment. And it's a very, very clear warning to women. It's like men in the 1950s saying, shut the fuck up, you uppity bitch. That's exactly what's going on now. But the thing is, we won't shut the fuck up.
And weren't there recently, like within this last 6 months or year, weren't there recently a series of, a set of academics who said, let's stop all this nonsense. And then they immediately started receiving just deluges of hate mail over that.
That's right. And in fact, Beatrix Campbell, who I've just mentioned, was one of the authors of the letter that went to the Observer newspaper. It was signed by a lot of prominent academics, activists, writers. I mean, obviously, you know, you're talking about some of the privileged elite as well as some political activists who are absolutely not the privileged elite. But, you know, we wanted names of people who bystanders would look at and think, oh, I've always really liked what she says on TV or on the radio or in print. If she's signing this letter, such as Mary Beard, the great historian, then, you know, it must be that there must be something in it. Peter Tatchell, who's a gay rights veteran in the UK, had, I think it was something like 600 tweets in a couple of hours because he signed a letter. And he was bullied into almost submission. He gave a kind of apology when he was confronted by some of the more vicious trans activists at a public debate. But you know, he absolutely stood for freedom of speech and the principle that we should be allowed to debate each other. He disagrees with me on my analysis of transgenderism, but he is he's a political person. He's an activist. So of course he wants discussion. And then there are those darlings of the left. You know, a young columnist called Owen Jones, who is seen as literally a poster boy of the hard left in the UK, who was too cowardly to sign the letter. And who, in fact, the day after the letter came out in The Observer, wrote his column about how trans people have been left out in the cold, pretty much blamed radical feminists for this, and nailed his colours to the mast by allying himself with the fun feminists and the pro-sex worker feminists. Terribly cowardly and very, very disappointing. So yes, it's happening across the board. And in a way, it's nice not to be the only one. You know, it was only me for about 7-8 years that was being no-platformed for these reasons in this country. But in another way, I don't want this to happen to any other women or male allies. I really don't. I just think, you know, there are strength in numbers and we can stand together on this. Thankfully, more people are speaking out. But as we do this, you know, the entrenched haters seem to be digging their heels in and getting, you know, more support off the unthinking liberals and libertarians.
What does it mean when, for society and for discourse in general, when pleas for open discourse, merely open discourse, not even specific political positions, are met with bullying and attempts to silence those calling merely for open discourse? What does this mean for the future, for the present and future of discourse in society?
It means that there will be no debate. There will be a set of agreed principles and opinions that we all have to abide by. It will mean we stop learning the art of debate and discussion. It will also mean that we never shift our views, we never evolve. And it's deeply concerning because it means the end of politics. This won't happen. This is a blip in the moment of time. And I think we can attribute it to neoliberalism and the depoliticization of many of the youth due to, you know, disaffected communities and I think a sort of slow destruction of the left in some ways. But as we start to rebuild that, then we will get back into the habit, including students, of listening to each other. The problem is now that here in the UK, we have an almost 100% middle-class privileged student intake because of the high cost of education that used to be publicly funded. And so it's only those with parents who can afford to send them to university that are going to do their degrees, which means that it's this privileged elite that are used to being listened to, are used to being able to speak up loudly in their own communities with confidence, that are going to be leading this totalitarian, McCarthyite, ridiculous state of affairs that we have now.
So we have, you have to catch a taxi in four minutes.
Yeah.
So can you do, like, what do you want people, in 1 minute, what do you want people to take away from this interview? Somebody heard this, and now what do you want them to do or change in their own lives and their approach to politics? What do you want them to do?
I want a return to the leftist principles that we had. An agreement that gender is socially constructed and not innate. That the sex trade is a gross example of capitalism gone berserk. That we have common aims and objectives that we adhere to, but debate and discussion within that. But more, I want to see less cowardice, more bravery, more robust challenging of these spoilt babies who are talking about their hurt feelings, demanding a safe space. There is no such thing as a safe space when you are a woman, when you're a gay man, when you're a person of colour, when you're a political activist fighting against the status quo or the state. And we need to recognise that demanding a safe space means it's a cocoon away from the front line. And on that front line, there are people who we need to ally ourselves with, because we cannot expect the most disenfranchised in society to carry on fighting and carry on kicking against huge state apparatus without the support of others. And I want a return to true liberal values, such as, you know, I don't like what you say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it, rather than what's now become known as so-called progressive values, which goes something like, you cannot say that, you are transphobic, whorephobic, offensive, you're hurting my feelings and I'm going to no-platform you. How have we come to that? So let's have some real, robust, brave countering of this nonsense.
Well, thank you so much for all that. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Julie Bindle. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.